Welcome to the Story Night podcast, where you hear true stories on a theme, recorded live on stage and without notes. I'm your host, Jessica Holmes. Today, we continue to be hooked on stories of cravings and compulsions with the last two hits from our January show. First, featured storyteller Al Blank befriends and battles the bottle with poetic intensity.
Thanks, Jess. It's really nice to see a crowd of normal drinkers. Because that ain't me. I was thinking about telling this story in the third person, and then I thought, let's just try it in the first person. We can switch. We'll make it a stream of consciousness if we have to. Omniscient narrators. Or I'll just goddamn lie to you. So really, we'll start this story with me sitting in kind of a ratty little recliner in a shed in 1996 in December. And I had a bed made by the special ed kids. And I'm watching TV on a little black and white with those little aluminum foil antenna ears. And I'm starting to think about where my life has kind of been for a while at age 50 and how it's just went to hell in a handbasket. For a guy who only drank every day but Sundays, and he never drank on Sundays and never drank on New Year's Eve and St. Patrick's Day, which were amateur days. And so how could anybody get into trouble, you know, when the Sabbath was free of alcohol? And Monday, Tuesday, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays were fair game. I'm originally from Wisconsin, and that's a state that loves Boilermakers. You know what a Boilermaker is, right? You know, a couple shots of brandy and a beer, and if you're really good, you can make a Black Panther cocktail and drop that right into the beer, just drink the whole damn thing. And everything that you do back in Wisconsin is centered around alcohol. Marriages, funerals, everything is an excuse to have some alcohol. And my parents were no different than that. Grew up in a nice little neighborhood filled with a bunch of boozers. And we'd go to the Red Eagle Tap, and I would play pool, and I would unload, at 10 years old, the beer cases in the bottom of the bar. And so alcohol just was like baby's milk. I mean, there was baby's milk, and there was Pabst Blue Ribbon and Leinenkugels and Point beer. And so how could there be any real problems? But when you have a father that dies at 59 living in a one-room ghetto flat, and you have a mother who dies at 61 on a couch by herself, and now you're 64, in hindsight, you look back and say, against the evidence, I live by choice, I guess. And I'm thinking, though, of all the really wonderful times when booze has just been this jack for me, just this full-tilt boogie jack. And I live for big doses of pure pleasure, and still do to some extent. And I remember my cousin coming back from Vietnam. And Brucey and I are sitting in his little house in Withy, Wisconsin, and we're drinking, and we're trying to tell some stories, because they really do tell good stories in Wisconsin, too. It's so goddamn cold for 6 months out of the year. You got nothing better to do but anesthetize yourself and tell stories. And so we're just talking and talking and telling stories, and, you know, there's this great Lee Michaels album for you people that are, you know, that age. And he's got this great song, "Would You Be Happy? Would You Be Sad?" And Frosty's hitting the drums, and we're just drinking and pounding them down. And the next thing we both realize, the Withy Fire Department is there pulling us out, and the place goes up in smoke, and the LP melts. And we thought that was just the most terrific situation in the world. And we were both alive against the evidence again to tell that story. And, you know, this was a time, too, back a little, some of those years back, where it was okay to drink and drive. You know, this whole red ribbon stuff is even makes me nervous today. I was I quit teaching and I was working as a slave, slave labor. You know, these guys would come out and hire you to do day work, and so I was unloading boxcars. And this guy says to me, "Were you on Highway 41 yesterday?" And I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, I think I saw you. Was there somebody in the car?" And I said, "Well, my brother and I had been up to a wedding, and we were driving back." And he said, "Do you remember hitting that dog?" And I said, "No." And so I go out, and I look at my bumper, and there's fur and blood. Huh? But you could drink and drive without any repercussions. You know, it was a freer time. And then I'm with Mallard, my buddy Mallard, and we're up at Green Bay, Titletown, Wisconsin, and we're having a few drinks, and we're dating a couple girls, and the next morning, there's a rap on the window, and the cop looks in, and he says, "Are you boys okay?" And Mallard's in the front, and I'm in the back, and I roll down the window. "Yeah, I guess we're okay." I said, "What time is it?" And he says, "It's about 6 o'clock." And I said, "Can you come back at 9? I'm a little tired." 9 o'clock, we get up, come out, and all the tires are slashed. Who knows what happens, right? That night, we end up in jail in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And the cop says to me, "I need your shoelaces." And I said, "I'm 250 pounds. I can't hang myself. You know, I'm 250 pounds here." And so this whole thing, this alcohol thing, just starts to, be an integral part of my life. It's inseparable from the marrow of this body. And so then I'm humping garbage. You know, I was a garbageman for 7 years in Milwaukee. And, you know, we used to tell you that you could hump garbage to 10 below zero. But they never told you about the wind chill factor, which went to 25 below. And so it was just an excuse to drink as much as you could to stay warm. And I had two guys that I humped garbage, two black guys, Tiny and Black Albert. And we would oftentimes, at the end of the day, because we always got done at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we'd go drinking and shooting pool, which I love to do. And we would always end up with situations. And one of them was we were shooting pool and got in this huge argument and fight with these three or four black guys in this bar. We were down in the inner city. And we decided to sprint and run outside. Now, Tiny weighs 400 pounds, right? And he's sprinting down the street, and I'm sprinting down the street, and Black Albert's sprinting down the street. And this is not a Bill Cosby-looking scene, right? And, you know, all of a sudden, 15 little black kids between the age of probably 5 and 15 are chasing us and throwing bricks and rocks and stuff at us. And this was just natural. And Black Albert's wife would always say to him, "Every time you're with the white boy, you get in trouble." And I thought it was an extremely racist thing to say. perceptive, but racist. And so all this time, you know, there's just these kind of parties going on and having good times and living for these big doses of pure pleasure. And my cousin Hans and Duke, they like to drink. And again, things would always get out of control. And I remember Hans one time saying to me, "You know, you were the best time in town last night." And what a pat on the back that is, you know? Especially when it's not a cop saying that to you. And so one day after work, they always laid me off, humping garbage. And so I went down and got drunk at Eater's Bar and went home. And the next morning, I'm waking up kind of thinking, "Oh, geez, something's not right about this." And so I walk out, and I look at my car, and it's all banged up in the front. So I walk about 10 blocks, and I go down, and I check around Eater's Bar, and sure enough, right, there's another car with a smashed-in front end, right? So I sell the car and get a drive-away car and go down to see Ed Abbey down in Arizona. I think, what a great time to go see Ed Abbey. And so I take the drive-away car down to Tucson, Arizona, and end up hitchhiking in Y, Arizona, meet a guy named Johnny Hoffman, who lets me stay with him. He's 70 years old, writing 1,000 poems, stanza about horses. And we continue to drink and with a bunch of these snowbirds, and I find out Abby's in Tucson, and I call him, and he says, "Come on, see me." So I go down, have dinner with Ed Abbey, stay with him, have a few beers the next day, head up to many farms to see another guy named Jerry Teklin, who I had as a teacher. hitchhike back out of the reservation. This guy picks me up in a convertible with two Afghan hounds, and he's drunk. And I'm thinking, I can drive better than him. And so I take his car, drive to Flagstaff, find his girlfriend, again, the only black woman in Flagstaff who likes a white drunk with two Afghan hounds. And she just says, again, what are you doing with this guy? Right. So after that, we kind of ended up segueing myself. I was going to go see Ken Kesey, ended up in jail in Ellensburg, Washington, and hitchhiked in January, straight back to Wisconsin, right back to the same car, because the police had found the car. And full circle, nothing had changed. I was still screwed. So these are all kind of humorous things up to a point, but in between there, things are kind of crazy. I'm 90% of the time, I'm a pretty decent drinker. 10%, I'm a nasty fuck. Straight up. I'm going to tell you straight up. If you meet me those 10% of those times, I will hurt you. I'll burn your house down. I will stab you. Okay? But the other 90% of the time, you'd love me. You will adore me. And what I would love to do is I would love to have a few drinks in the house at night and then put on some blues music, which I love the blues. And I'd be, you know, listening to some Junior Wells Messing with the Kid, right? Or Somebody Loan Me a Dime by Fenton Robinson. And I'd be drinking a few and drinking a few and drinking a few. Now remember, this is not Sunday, right? And so I would get on the phone. I love the phone. I'm a phone freak. And I would call people at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I would be reciting poetry to them and say, listen to this blues song. And I'd be whirling around the house, messing with the kid. Right? And Dwarf's wife would say, it's your bastard drunken friend again. Your bastard drunken friend again. And Dwarf said, I'll talk to him, right? Dwarf wrote a poem about me. It's called Al Mountain Blank. And it was published in 1979 in a book called To Catch the Sun. And the first stanza goes, he prepared himself well. Many gallons of whiskey, beer, and wine have fueled the madman. He has been the best part of 10 years. Now, this was 1979. And now I'm sitting in a shed in 1996. You can do the math, okay? You can do the math. So Mallard and I, Mallard keeps creeping back into my life, and he decides that we're going to go down to Arizona again, and we're going to stay with a guy named R.P. Dickey, who's this huge, huge man, about 6'3", 220 pounds, holds the world's power weightlifting record, and a fine, fine poet. And we're going to go down and visit with him, and we're going to stay in his house. And R.P. had this big shock of hair, and he called himself the redheaded nigger. And he was huge, man, and powerful reader. He would read these poems, you know. I pick a jug of apple cider and just, man, it would just electrify you. And so Mallard and I decided, since we're that far, we'll hitchhike into Mexico. Well, we get partway down and decide there's no booze left, so we come back to Tucson. Play pool, get in a fight at Choo Choo's Bar. If you've ever been in Tucson a long time ago, there's a place called Choo Choo's. So I break the pool cue because I lost this game, which was unusual. Not breaking the pool cue, but losing. And we head back to RP's. The next night, RP decides to have a poetry reading. And so Mallard and I go to the reading at his girlfriend's house, MK's. And everything's fine, and RP's reading powerfully, and I'm enjoying this. And Mallard, because he's such a dink, says to RP, I think that you should make that line break somewhere else. Quiet. Very quiet now. And RP looks at him and says, David, right? Didn't call him Mallard, didn't call him Dave. Says, David, this is not the time for criticism. So I know this is the time to leave, right? And so we get a cab and we head back to RP's, and MK calls 10 minutes after we're there. She says, RP's coming for you. And we look out the window, and there's the blue whale coming up the mountain, lights going around the curves. We grab our bag, slink through the desert, next day in a driveway car, back to Wisconsin. Again, everything is about the booze. Everything is surrounded by this. And so it just keeps going on and on. Back in Boise, things are happening. I have a good friend named Jack the Sprat, who's, the, in my estimation, the only original poetic voice in all of Boise. And I'm a pretty decent poet, I think. Lots of good poets here. But Jack the Sprat is the only original voice. And Spratt and I would go to poetry readings. We'd go to the Boulevard Bar down in Garden City. And he loved Donald Hall, the poet Donald Hall. So Hall was coming to town. And so we went to see Donald Hall and hear him. And after that, what did we do? We decided to go drink again. And so I leave Spratt, and he drops me off at the house, and I hear a crash. And I go out the door, and I look across the street, and there's Spratt through the fence with his car, and the guy happens to be a cop, and he's got a gun at Spratt's head, and I'm screaming, "Don't kill him, don't kill him." Sad, sad, sad but true. And so all this thing's slowly starting to spiral out of control, right? And instead of just having occasionally shot, and then I say, okay, this is too much for me, maybe I'll just have a small glass of wine. Instead of a small glass of wine, I'll just have maybe a mixed drink. Things start going crazier and crazier and crazier. The dancing becomes more lonely at night. And then one night I'm at the Cactus Bar with a friend and come home. And that night, about 1 o'clock, I called the police on myself. And the next morning, Coach bails me out of jail. And as I'm coming out of jail, really remorseful and full of shame, I pass this guy coming into the jail, and he gives me this kind of stink eye. And I look at him, and I said to him, "Do you have a scratch to itch, partner? Because let's go out in the gravel." Right? 4 hours in jail, still looking for trouble, right? Get out of the jail, go home, 6 o'clock in the morning, it's dark. The house is empty. 2 hours later, the police rap on the door. They say, "Come with me, pack a bag. You're gone for 90 days at least." Pack the bag, leave. And across from the subway in the Y, there used to be a motel. It's down now. It's a parking lot. I got a room on the second floor that night, and I called a dwarf. And I had visited him earlier because he had brain cancer. And we've been friends for a long, long time. And he has 4 wives, so he's addicted too. And I tell him what transpired that night. And he's telling me about his 4th wife who's having an affair. And he says, "It's amazing the horrible things we do to the people we love." And then he tells me the cancer is back. And I hang up. And I make a phone call. Didn't even know that number existed. And a half hour later, there's a rap on the door. And I go with that person in his car, a couple blocks to a church on 12th Street. And we walk into that room, and he visits with friends. And I sit down in the back and hang my head. And provided we remember, we will provide it for. And then somebody says, "If there's anybody here in their first 30 days who would like to give us their name so we can get better acquainted at the end of this meeting, my name's Al, and I'm an alcoholic." Thank you.
Thank you, Al. Next, story slammer Greg Duffy finds himself in strange company during a potential barroom brawl.
Okay, there's a few rules that I always go by. One is you never lie to your mother, so you always tell the truth. And that, of course, means that when you see somebody with an addiction, you really have no idea what to do. Okay, the other thing is we're talking about old cars. I had an old car with a carburetor, my old Ford Fairlane. Could drive it anywhere, get vapor lock, then that thing was frozen in time until it cooled down completely, take 45 minutes to an hour. Anyway, the story starts out in Black River Falls, Wisconsin, 1978. I had a job pumping gas there. It was a long, hot summer, and I was working with this guy. He was a really great guy named Johnny Pope. And the boss would walk through several times a day, walk through and just say hi to us, say, "Hi, Duffy. Hi, Pope," and just keep on going. Then after a while, he started calling Johnny the Pope, which I thought was a little weird, you know. He never called me the Duffy, but okay, whatever. So anyway, we're out there, we're pumping gas. You know, this is back in full service times when you pump gas, you wash windows, check the oil. Anyway, this one day I'd worked 6 days in a row, and Johnny says, "Hey, after work tonight, how about we go out for some beers?" Okay, worked 6 days in a row, hot, beer. I mean, could anyone have said no? Really? Come on. So anyway, Johnny got off a half hour before me. He tells me to meet at the bar. So I said, sure, no problem. So I drive down there, and it's almost back to my apartment. And I stop, and I walk into the bar, and there he is at the bar. No, he's gone because the door shut behind me. It's black. I can't see anything. So I finally, my eyes adjust, and I see him there. He waves me over. I sit down, and they clarify all these little bottles of beer. And it's like, okay. He says, have yourself a shorty. And it's like, is that a beer? And he says, yeah, it's a beer. And so he waves to the bartender to present me with my first shorty, which is a little 8-ounce beer. Sometimes they called them ponies or something like that. But anyway, I mean, a cold beer on a hot day was a wonderful thing. And so, and you know, we're sitting there, we're talking, and, you know, you can't talk about pumping gas. There's no story there. So, I mean, really, come on. So Johnny has a couple of beers. That's what it took to get through the story about him going fishing when he was a kid, and a couple more beers, and he was on to telling me about high school. He'd take off after school and go hunting for deer, and a couple more shorties, and a couple more shorties, and a couple more shorties. And he was starting to run out of stories, and I was watching my paycheck disappear as the bartender keep presenting me with these little things. And it's really hard to nurse a beer when it's so tiny, you know? So anyway, I was just kind of looking around the place. It was getting quiet because Johnny ran out of stories. And then he just kind of leans over, gives me a nudge, and says, I'm going to punch that guy. He's like, hello, what did I miss? What guy? And he says, the Indian. So I'm looking around the place, and I noticed there was this guy that was sitting next to me the whole time, never said a word to me. His hands were kind of tan, something I never accomplished in my lifetime, but he must be the Indian. But then there's some people talking behind me. So I look back. Yeah, and there was this older couple, and they were sitting there. They were talking. They were kind of tan, too. So I guess they're Indians, too. I knew there was a reservation around, but okay. So I leaned back and said, come on, Johnny. Everybody's having a nice time. It's quiet. And he says, I'm going to punch him. So I'm thinking, that's it. I'm out of here. So I stand up. I put my hand in my pocket. I got the Ford Fairlane. That's not going to start for another half hour. God, I'm stuck. So I sit back down, and then it's like, wait, this is it's Tuesday. I'm going to call my mom tomorrow. I can see this playing out. Johnny's going to punch the Indian. There's two more Indians behind me. They're going to get in there. This is going to wind us up with us both in jail. I got to call my mother tomorrow. What am I going to say? And you can't lie to your mother. What do you do? So I had to think up a plan, and so I'm sitting there. I'm stewing about it, and I think, I got it. Okay, Johnny, here's the deal. If we're going to have a bar fight, I get to throw the first punch. And Johnny smiled and leaned back. I say, here's the plan. You get up off of that bar stool. I'm going to slap you into next week. So just sit there, finish your beer, then go home. And he's glaring at me, and I'm staring back at him. Now, I've never punched a guy in my life, but I wasn't about to explain that to Johnny, you know? And so we're both staring at each other for a minute, maybe two. Johnny tips his beer up. He sets it back down. He spins around so his back's to me. And three steps, and he's out the door. And it's like, oh, my God. I mean, I'd love to think I was brilliant, but I was just damn lucky. And so I nursed the last of my little tiny beer, and I checked my time, and the car had enough time to cool down, so, okay, I could leave now. So I go out, and I get into the car, and that was my first exposure to a real addiction. And I got in the car, I started it up, and I started pulling away, and I thought, what would I have told my mother if this broke into a fight? If Johnny had lashed out at me instead of the Indian, I mean, this would have... Okay, you can't lie to your mother. So I know what I would do if I got into that fight. I'd call her up and I'd say, hi, Mom. Hey, last night I got into a bar fight. Now it's okay. I didn't do anything wrong. I was just having some beers with the Pope. Next thing I knew, we were surrounded by Indians. And then the fight broke out.
Thank you for listening. Story Story Night is brought to you by presenting partner the Boise State Story Initiative, venue partner the Lennon Building, design partner Neighborhood All-Stars, and our broadcast partner Boise State Public Radio. Please donate now at radio.boisestate.edu. Our Story Story Night theme is by Dan Costello. Hear more at hearcostello.com. Please join us next week for a podcast exclusive teaser to preview our February 28th event, Star-Crossed Love, Stories of Fated Attractions. Learn more at storystorynight.org.